Thanks very much, Toby. That was really, really helpful. We've now got a panel discussion with Lorraine Whitmarsh, who is a professor in environmental psychology at Bath University and director of CAST, which is the Centre for Climate Change and Social Transformation. Welcome. What we'll do is sort of have a little panel discussion now, and then I'll throw sort of questions in about 20 minutes or so. We had quite a few people talking about plastic bags or recycling, the small steps that they are taking. And I think there's a long-running question about whether those small steps are a gateway or a cul-de-sac. So do people do those small things, it becomes part of their identity, they then act consistently with those small steps and do bigger things? Or do they think, well, I've done my bit, I don't need to bother with the heat pump and the EV, and possibly they come away without even appreciating what are the big fish and the big things that you need to do like those, and think, well, actually, plastic bags has done the job. So what does the actual evidence suggest? Is it a gateway or is it a cul-de-sac?
This is a topic that I've been very interested in for a while. So the idea of behavioural spillover. So does changing one behaviour lead on to other positive behaviours in line with that? And while the idea is very enticing, it would be great to think you just get, you know, people start recycling and think, oh, I'm quite a green person, maybe there's more I can do. The evidence is pretty weak that that happens automatically. That under very certain circumstances, you can take people down that path. If they see a connection between that first behaviour and subsequent ones, so they see that they're both green behaviours, if they're both aligned in terms of skills, so if they know how to do the subsequent thing, and so on. But very often, the conditions are not there to link those behaviours. There might be barriers to doing the subsequent things. As we've heard, it can be costly, inconvenient, etc., to do those more impactful things. So people often do stop at the first thing and don't do other things.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. I think spillovers are definitely a thing, and they can go in both directions. The problem is it's very difficult to really predict which way it's going to go. I think it's just highly risky as a strategy. It's also a bit of a get-out. It's very easy, perhaps, as a policymaker or an influencer to think, you know what, we just focus on the easy stuff that people are on board with, and then it will just naturally flourish into wider green behaviours. And unfortunately, it just doesn't always pan out that way, particularly, as Lorraine says, when there are other material barriers in the way of those big behaviours. We need to focus on removing those barriers.
One of the things that I really liked about the report is the sort of framework you set out around upstream, downstream, midstream. And it really broadens our sense of what behavioural research looks like. Rather than caricaturing it as just at the sort of downstream level, you're looking at a whole set of levers and ways of influencing human behaviour. One interesting aspect of that is the role of complex adaptive systems and systems thinking, because I think one of the interesting aspects of that research suggests that there are particular points of intervention that can have disproportionate effect because it can create a virtuous cycle. And if you can find those points of leverage, it can, you know, really catalyse a whole set of things. And I'm just interested in how do you translate that theoretical idea into actual examples where if we do find this particular point of leverage, it will really have outsized impact. Are there specific case studies that you can point to?
Yeah, I think it's a relatively new area of research. I mean, obviously, systems thinking has been around for a long time, but applying it through this sort of behavioural lens specifically in this context. I used to be an engineer, so a natural lens for me is to think about things in terms of feedback loops and systems and so on. I think we all have a sort of intuitive understanding of what we mean by positive and negative feedback, whether we know it or not. Like, okay, I'm holding a pen. Like, that is a positive feedback loop. Any disturbance from equilibrium accelerates itself. That is a negative feedback loop. Any disturbance creates a returning force, so it's a force of stasis and stability. That's no less true for a pen as it is for a social system or an economic system, in that there will tend to be forces of stasis, things like path dependencies where previous decisions sort of dictate and constrain future outcomes, or negative feedback loops, which can also, by the way, be psychological. So things like our tendency for habit or status quo bias or our proclivity for defaults or our aversion to risk, for example. All of these things tend to reinforce the status quo in various forms. But there are also positive feedback loops within social systems. Social norms, for example, can spread contagiously. So once you get enough of something happening, it can actually sort of spread like wildfire. The relationship between supply and demand, if supply is unconstrained, can also be a great positive feedback loop. So, for example, we see that more and more people are starting to explore plant-based vegetarian food. At the moment, it's still quite niche, but it's sort of, you know, it's growing. What that means is then suppliers see that there's an increasing market potential there, so they will develop more options, they'll put more marketing money into that, and that, of course, creates a choice environment in which these products and offerings are more attractive, higher quality, cheaper, and so more people buy them, and so on, the virtuous cycle can go. So I think the point here is not just to pontificate about systems, interesting though they are, but to sort of identify concrete ways in which we can either remove or overcome these negative feedback loops that are sort of forces of stasis and resist change, and ways we can leverage and prepare for runaway change where we want it. And that can be as banal as things like thinking about supply chains and making sure we're prepared to allow this sort of succession of potential tipping points and feedback to occur. So if you think about something like EV adoption, electric vehicles are getting more and more popular. As they increase in popularity, a lot more investment is going into battery technology. In an ideal world, that might mean that battery prices plummet and then the technology improves. That might then improve adjacent industries such as the potential for electric flights eventually, home storage solutions, grid storage solutions, and so on. That might then eventually become a sufficiently big change that oil and fossil fuel companies start to reinvent themselves as they become at risk of having stranded assets and so on. So these things can sort of create a bit of a domino effect. But it's not inevitable that that will happen. You could imagine a situation in which the complete opposite happens, in which EV uptake drives more competition for finite resources, lithium, microchips, and so on. And so adjacent industries end up competing with each other for resources rather than benefiting from each other's success. And that keeps prices high and demand low. And then oil companies continue to thrive and invest in fossil fuels and so on. So two possible futures can just sort of spiral into existence from quite small differences in the starting conditions. So I think it's just so important that we actually prepare for and enable as much as we can these sort of positive feedbacks that can really accelerate change.
I would just say there's some really interesting research that's tried to model at what percentage of the population needs to be advocating for change for a society to adopt that new behaviour, for example. And while estimates kind of vary, it's somewhere in the region of about 25%. So it doesn't have to be a majority, basically, until we sort of get that tipping point. Actually, you just need an active minority of people saying, this is a new behaviour that I want to adopt, e.g. a plant-based diet or something, and then it starts to kind of really accelerate and take off. And the other thing that is relevant to this area is around the fact that a lot of our behaviour is very habitual. We're sort of locked into our routines and we just do the same thing over and over again within a sort of stable context. But there are times, as your report highlights, where our habits are weakened. And so, for example, if you've moved house or maybe you retire or a business is making a strategic decision about how to invest. So there are particular sort of key decision points that then it's important to target your intervention to those moments of change where the inertia is a bit weaker, where you actually have more traction. So I think it's as well as thinking about how can we accelerate those trends, it's also how can we use those sort of weaknesses in our sort of lock-ins to break through and create change as well.
That's really interesting that you said that 25% is the threshold at which it then becomes dominant. Interested to know more about that, but also, are there particular individuals who you could target who would be much more influential? So we're very obsessed by heat pumps at Nesta because we've got this mission on sustainable future, which is all about home decarbonisation. And one little idea is that we should target all our renewable heat subsidies at plumbers and boiler fitters, because if all the sort of boiler fitters had heat pumps, instead of coming around to your house and sucking their teeth and going, oh, not sure this will work, they'll probably become sort of heat pump advocates. And I'm just wondering, it sounds a bit sort of off the wall, but is that the sort of thing which could potentially have disproportionate impact?
I would think so, because I mean, what we know is that you have to have a trusted communicator for any message to be listened to and acted on. And the people coming round to your home and installing things or servicing them. So these are people you would see regularly, even if you're not necessarily thinking about kind of changing your boiler. But if they're there and able to say, oh, have you thought about this new technology? They're going to be credible communicators rather than, say, maybe, well, the government or just people that don't necessarily have clear expertise in the area. So I think, yeah, that seems like a great idea to me.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think the broader point as well is that if you want behaviours to spread, they need to be visible to other people. So this is the reason why the UK has green number plates on electric vehicles, so that non-EV drivers will start to perceive them as increasingly normal and so on. And of course, one of the issues with heat pumps, but also retrofits and other things, is that a lot of these behaviours happen behind closed doors. And so they may well be becoming increasingly common, and yet other people just aren't aware of that fact. So that contagion effect cannot materialise.
And could we make our homes more visibly green?
I think we can. I mean, there are ways. I mean, even things as small as clear labels on property listings, for example, so that you're aware that a home is heat pump ready, for example, and that becomes a sort of more familiar term, or when a property is being retrofitted, have some kind of signage outside. You know, that's why builders and estate agents do that anyway, because they know that it will potentially spread their business. So I think we can lean on those kind of techniques as well.
Can we go now sort of more to politics? Because you had quite a few facts in your presentation about how much public support there is for various measures. I think my first question is, I mean, Lorraine, do you actually believe those figures in the sense that, you know, don't people, when polled, say, look, I'd love to pay more taxes and do all sorts of things, and then in reality they don't? Should we not be distrustful of those sorts of polls?
Well, we've done very similar polls and we find the same thing. So I do trust the polls in the sense that I think it is a robust finding. But you're right to point to the fact that in the abstract, people are more likely to agree with certain things than when you point out any sort of costs, financial costs or lifestyle costs. This will be very, very inconvenient to you or mean that you can't do these things. So when it becomes a bit more sort of tangible and actually people realise that there would be implications for them, then support does tend to drop. And we did some research showing that, for example, flyer levy, as you showed, about 60% or so, we showed similar levels of support. But then when we said, but this will cost you personally some money potentially, then support dropped to about half of that amount. So, and similarly for almost all the policies that we asked about, and we asked about a whole range, where there was an exception, it was the one that said that the products would reflect the environmental impact, so that greener products would cost less, but less green products would cost more. And support stayed the same, even when we kind of spelt out, but that could mean that the sort of cost could change for you. And that was because I think people were sort of calculating, but actually I could change my choices and potentially not have to pay more. So there are sort of a few exceptions, but absolutely the more you spell out maybe some of the implications for people, support does drop. Equally though, it's worth saying, if you point out some of the wider benefits of these behaviours, you could then counteract some of that, I think. So that it's not inevitable that the more real it becomes, the less support you get, but that's something that comes in.
I think that we would never consider these data as absolute gospel, but I do think they fairly reliably show a pretty strong foundation of public support. Obviously, it's not the only data point we have as well, because we can also look to things like deliberative fora and citizens' assemblies and so on, where people have a lot more time and attention to really think through the implications of these policies, and yet still, time and time again, these events put out really strong recommendations from the public and a lot of support. I think there's also something really interesting on the political question around what we even mean and understand by behaviour change. And that's been, I think, one of the challenges that we've faced in having these conversations in the past with politicians. But I think it's tended to stem from a couple of misperceptions, one around the means of behaviour change and one around the ends of behaviour change. So there's often a bit of an intuitive reaction where people think that by behaviour change, what we mean by the ends is some kind of more abstemious future, some kind of giving up of modern convenience. And what people assume by the means is that it requires some kind of finger wagging, a curtailment of freedoms, and so on. And then what we tried to do in this report, partly by showing that actually the public are really on board with this range of ideas, but also partly through the sort of upstream, downstream model, is to show that actually neither of those assumptions need be correct. It's actually often more about building an enabling environment, building an enabling choice architecture in which these green behaviours can flourish. And actually, there's often a very sort of positive, helpful sort of enabling frame to what we're trying to do, rather than one that's about sort of telling people what they shouldn't be doing.
But there are some pretty big things that have to happen in the next 10 years that are on the more regulatory side. So let's assume, you know, you have to ban boilers, phase them out. You have to potentially put a tax on food, was one of the suggestions you had up there. Those are things that policymakers will know are perfectly sensible things, and have known for years, but are politically very, very difficult. How do you build momentum so that if you can't do that now, how do you build towards being able to do that in 4, 5, 6 years' time?
Yeah, a big part of it is doing it well in advance. One thing we say in the report is that if we're going to ban products like gas boilers and so on, we really need to do it in such a way that the market, manufacturers, etc., have enough of a lead time and notice of that policy that before it really bites, the alternative, i.e. heat pumps, is already the better choice for consumers, so that we can rely on an early adopter curve of voluntary adoption, which then obviously increases investment in R&D in the alternative products. And so eventually, hopefully, by the time, it, you know, say it's 2035, that gas boilers, new gas boilers, that is, you can still use your existing one and get it repaired, of course, a band, already the obvious choice because it's cheaper, more effective, cheaper to run, etc., will hopefully be heat pumps, and therefore it becomes a sort of non-issue. Mm-hmm. So it's about that sort of continuity, I think, of policy making for me.
Yeah, and I think the other thing, which again the report does point out, is that it is about building that foundation through communications and public engagement. So at the moment, the public doesn't have a clear sense of where we're going on net zero, what the vision is, what their role is in any sort of transition to net zero, the fact that they will have to change their behaviour, and what the ways and the pros and cons to do that. So providing that vision, engaging with people, and actually creating some of those policies with people, actually, so it factors in their concerns and needs, not only builds acceptability of those policies, but actually makes them better in the sense that it does take account of people's different conditions. And so the fairness is built in, because if people are worried about certain groups being left behind or that they might be penalised unfairly. So actually, by listening to people and factoring in those concerns, actually you tend to get better decisions.
I mean, one thing that I think that politicians will think about is, look, do we defer a phase out of XYZ product until we've got enough early adoption and it's familiar and liked? Or do we actually put in place a regulation 10 years out, and part of the kind of way of getting early adoption is exactly that kind of clarity that we're making a green transition, and we can just about take the hit because it's so far away we won't get flak. But Lorena, what's your advice on that conundrum?
I think I would point to two reports recently that say the latter is pretty important. So coming out of the House of Lords inquiry on behaviour change for climate goals last year, and the Skidmore review more recently, both of them really said what we need is policy certainty, clarity about kind of, you know, things like what domestic energy, in order that companies can then invest in these areas. They know for certain that this is a target or a goal that is going to be in place for a number of years, as opposed to bringing in and out these different sorts of regulations or ideas and no sense of certainty about what to invest in. So from those two reports, it's clear that you absolutely need to have that, and then businesses will invest, and then the public knows where they're going as well.
And I think that's why the heat pump strategy is so much more developed than the possible alternative of hydrogen, because there isn't yet any clarity in what the government's strategy around hydrogen may be. And until we have that, it's just very hard for businesses to invest in R&D, supply chains, etc.
So we've talked quite a bit about policy and politics. Now, what about the role of business? What can they do, and what do you say in the report, Toby?
I think businesses play an absolutely critical role. Again, another quite interesting thing about the upstream-downstream model is that the midstream area, that is creating proximate choice environments that are really conducive to low-carbon choices, a lot of that kind of ultimately comes down to businesses, and I would say local authorities, service designers and so on. But these groups are really, they're essentially the architects of our choice environments. You think about a business like a supermarket, the extent to which different choices are made easy, available, accessible, prominently positioned, how they're priced, etc. A lot of that comes down to businesses. So there's a huge amount that businesses can do independently if they are minded to do so, be that defaulting people into the green choice, establishing favourable pricing, incentives, etc. Mm-hmm. I think the point we kind of lean on in the report, though, is you've also got to ask, well, why would businesses do that? And, of course, there are plenty of green, well-meaning businesses out there, but ultimately profit motives are likely to prevail, which is why we also tend to focus on that upstream piece. What's the supermarket's choice architecture or choice environment from their perspective? What incentives are they facing? What norms within their industry are they facing? And so ultimately all of these things are sort of linked, but absolutely businesses are key. And maybe one quick thing I'll add as well is that another useful lens that I think businesses tend to think through is how can they decarbonize their scope 1, 2, and 3 emissions? And of course, scope 1 and scope 2 is largely internal operations, so under their direct control. Scope 3, both up and down the value chain outside of their direct operations, almost necessitates, almost by definition, a behaviour change approach, because you're looking to influence the actions of your suppliers or your customers. And even beyond that, what people are kind of referring to as scope X emissions, this idea that completely outside of your own products and services, what other emissions might you be able to influence as an organisation? So we did a nice piece of work with Sky, who recognised quite rightly that actually the biggest impact they could have on the world is not through their own operations, not through even their scope 3 emissions, but through the influence they can have on the wider public through their content and how that can encourage low carbon lifestyles and so on. So, I mean, the list of things that businesses can do is huge, and I think the role of governments is really to sort of set the incentives and the market conditions within which it is preferable and favourable for businesses to do those things.
That's a really good point, and it links to actually the fact that we try to define behaviour change in its very broadest sense, because if we think about people taking action, it isn't only private citizens in their homes investing in a boiler or deciding to walk somewhere. Those people are also professionals. They work, they are part of organisations, and to different extents they may be able to influence that organisation, even if it's just asking their manager, why do we not have a green supplier for this, or themselves taking some of those choices. So I think it is about thinking about the behaviour change within that professional context as well. And in that sense, yes, businesses play an absolutely critical role, and individuals have a role in shaping those choices.
Let's start with a couple of sectors first, and then we'll go to the audience. Firstly, on the home energy side, it feels to me like there are two quite big behaviours that you need to get people to take. One is one-off purchasing decisions, like retrofitting their home or buying a heat pump. But then there's the more ongoing daily optimization that people need to do, where they might change the time at which they use their appliances or allow their home to go slightly colder or overheat their home for a certain time because they can then relieve pressure on the grid later on during the day. It seems both of those are huge things to navigate on their own at the moment. It feels like the moment we're at the downstream end of the spectrum, when actually we need to be at the midstream or the upstream end. So, Lorraine, I don't know whether you've thought further about this and what do you think needs to happen if we're going to see the scale and pace of change required?
It's clear from the report that there are lots of barriers to progress in this area. Some of them are on the supply side in terms of having skilled people that can install heat pumps and so on, the speed that's required. But there are also some of the things that are more on the householder side. And I've touched on timing, but I think, you know, it is potentially as well about thinking when is the best time to intervene. So is it when having a conversation, when you're having your boiler serviced, about potentially upgrading it, or when somebody moves house and they might be renovating a property, those sorts of times when people kind of accept some level of disruption to their home, and you might be able to say, and have you also thought about doing some energy efficiency upgrades while you're getting a new kitchen or something? Mm-hmm. There are ways in which we can accelerate this, but certainly there are plenty of barriers, I think, that are pointed to in the report.
Do you think it's plausible that energy companies, retail energy companies, could shift to being energy service companies, and instead of making their money out of just selling more stuff, making their money through helping people manage demand? Because I think my scepticism is that the fundamental market dynamics don't drive that. Mm. And yes, for a small number of customers and maybe for a small number of players, they may get there. But the bulk of what retail energy companies are going to be doing is just flogging more interesting gas.
I think it's plausible that we could see some of that emerging. It causes some issues, right? If you move to sort of heating as a service type model, the benefit of that, of course, is you shift the incentive for efficiency onto the suppliers. The downside is that you might create a bit of a moral hazard situation where now you remove all incentive potentially from the consumer to be efficient. So I don't know, I think the jury's out on that one.
You could share the benefits, though, couldn't you, with the consumer?
True enough, yeah. Yeah, I mean, what's your view? You probably know more about this than many of us.
Well, I worry that you need some intermediary that's going to help people navigate this transition, both the one-off decisions but also the ongoing ones. And all of the agents have got major weaknesses. So yeah. Electricity companies, given the structure of the market, it's hard to see their incentives really aligning. Local authorities, people talk about them a lot, but they have no real competence and capability in this area, so it's hard to, from a standing start, to get them up to speed. Sure. A National Energy Agency, possibly, but again, new institute. So I worry that we haven't got a good intermediary, and yet we need one if we're going to make it easy.
Yeah. So I think there's a few sort of key points here. On heat pumps specifically, I think this is one area where actually the government has a really exciting policy in the pipeline, which is a market mechanism. Again, I'm sure many people are familiar with this, but essentially it sets the incentive on manufacturers to sell more low-carbon heating solutions, i.e. heat pumps, and less gas boilers. The nice thing about that is it doesn't dictate the how. It leaves capitalist ingenuity unto itself, but it just creates that incentive through a tradable scheme. And the idea is that they maybe are not best placed right now to solve all of the problems through that adoption journey, but there is a range of things that could be put in place by them, whether that's improving supply chains and installation, home survey experience, driving consumer demand, improving the product, reducing prices, etc. So I think that's quite exciting. On the retrofit side, we think there is a need for this sort of new intermediary. Our version of that is a sort of one-stop shop, mm-hmm. managed by government, but it doesn't necessarily have to be government, which is a truly integrated service through which you can book a home survey, get tailored advice, you've got access to an approved directory of suppliers, you've got meaningful guarantees of quality work and so on, because I do think there's so many frictions in that process that we just need to make it as streamlined as we can.
Great. So, I mean, the report actually has more recommendations on other sectors like food, materials, transport. So if anyone's got questions on those particular sectors, please do put your hand up. But I'll throw it open to any questions from the audience. Let's take three in a row and then we'll go from there. So two in the back there and then come to this side.
I wanted to follow up on the gateway versus cul-de-sac. So how would you feel, Lorraine? I agree that the evidence is pretty weak there. What are your thoughts on diet? Is there a good reason to believe that if we start to eat lower on the food chain that we'll keep going? Or do you think people are just going to kind of settle in, which we've seen a lot of? People will eat less of the red when we label it and move just to chicken if we're just going to keep labeling chicken yellow. Mm-hmm. And I have concerns that that sector can absorb all the demand for people who want to eat meat and what the knock-on effects of that might be.
Great. Let's take three in a row and then, yeah.
Hello, thank you very much. My name is Freya Roberts. I work for the UCL Climate Action Unit. And my question is about the intention action gap, which Professor Whitmarsh mentioned. So that was the gap between the level of support for a green behaviour from the public and then actually the level of kind of uptake or action. And I want to ask the panel how we can measure the latter and related to that, how we can identify the barriers that cause that intention action gap, because that's kind of really interesting, not only to know what people's intentions are under perfect circumstances, but actually to know what action we're really achieving.
Okay, thank you. And then one at the back. Yep.
Hi, it's Stu Horn from Energy Saving Trust, and I've had a read through the report, and it's absolutely fantastic. I was wondering if you, in writing it, had got a feeling for where are the areas of most impact that you get from the different behaviours, so which ones are the real areas of priority to focus in on?
Okay, great. You can pick and choose what you want to answer.
Happy to talk about spillover. Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good point. And actually, yesterday we were talking about kind of data as well. And I think you maybe know more about how some of the dietary choices are actually playing out outside of what people are reporting in terms of their diet. So I think this also speaks to the second point around kind of how you measure behaviour. So we really need to have much better indicators of what people's choices actually are, because a lot of the time we do rely on intentions or willingness or even self-report. And people like to say, oh yes, I've done all these green things, and conveniently perhaps forget or just not want to report some of the less green things they do. So we do need better data, definitely. I think on spillover around diet, I'm not sure if I've seen sort of studies particularly on that, but I think it does come down to the kind of motivation sitting behind whatever people are doing. And so we did a study on carrier bag reuse. And so when the charge came in to the carrier bag charge, we were interested in whether people that then responded to the charge by bringing their own bags to the supermarket were more likely to reduce waste in other ways. And we found they weren't at all. There was absolutely no effect on any other behaviours. And we hypothesised that it might have been because they were responding to it as a sort of charge, a financial measure. They didn't want to pay the 5p or whatever. And so that was the sort of rationale sitting behind that decision, as opposed to an environmental, I want to reduce my waste or I want to be green. Whereas if they had been doing it for those motives, it may have been possible for them to then make a connection with what are the other things I can do to reduce my waste. And I guess with the food example then, if people are switching from red meat to white meat because they want to reduce their carbon footprint, that might be why they're sticking with white meat and not going to plant-based, even though that would be even better. But if that's the sort of signal is just get out of red meat and that's one of the best things you can do. But I guess if they're thinking about it from other reasons, and it could be sort of health or it could be animal welfare, then they may go further to increasing plant-based. So I haven't seen any specific studies on that, but I think you're right to point out that we want to be kind of maybe thinking about sort of some of the wider effects of these interventions and not just thinking inevitably it will lead to the right choice.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. Diet's a really interesting one because it's one of the easiest and most impactful changes we can all make in our lives, and yet it still seems to be quite emotionally charged and sort of politically challenging. Like Lorraine, I've not seen any specific studies that look specifically at spillovers within diet. I am aware that people often sort of crowd in additional justifications to their changes. So let's say, for example, people change their diet for animal welfare reasons, they might find that sort of post hoc they start to become greener in their attitudes because now it's rather easy to do so because you can tell yourself a story that you're being sustainable and so on. I think it's plausible that positive spillovers will be more likely sort of within domain rather than across domains because the mechanism that apparently drive spillovers, such as a sort of reinforcement of consistency and a tendency to adopt a green identity and so on. I think it makes more plausible sense when it's a similar behaviour that you're sort of escalating rather than jumping to something quite different. On the question about the intention action gap, absolutely. I mean, we would always try and rely on sort of hard administrative data to observe actual behaviours. So we, of course, have lots of self-report data around what people are willing to do, what they already say they do. But, and we do this in the report. I can cover it in detail in the presentation, but we also draw on, you know, DfT data on actual vehicle registrations, AHDB and DEFRA data on meat production and imports in the UK and so on. So we can observe quite clearly that, for example, even though the common narrative is that more and more people are starting to eat plant-based, yes, that seems to be true, and yes, you do see that in retail sales data, for example. The macro picture of production in the UK, you can't really yet see a perceptible dent, at least not last time I looked at that data. So it's really important to zoom in on that hard data.
Should we take the cluster of questions over there? Yeah, let's take the back row, that's all right.
Hi, Marcus Shepherd from the CCC. Thanks for a really interesting talk. One of the things we're really interested in at the moment is around the provision of information, and particularly one part of that is how the government can set a high-level narrative around this and sort of how the government uses its platform to create messages. One of the things we've noticed, so by way of example, during the pandemic, the high-level messaging was hands, face, space. But I would argue that the focus on hand washing was a bit of a distraction from what were actually like the needed behaviours. So my question to the panel is, what is the right evidence base that the government should use when it is forming sort of high-level messages like this? How should it prioritise messages and evaluate where messages may be in tension with each other, sort of as Toby noted, sort of like the focus on, say, switching off lights rather than sort of reducing heat? And lastly, sort of, you know, what should those messages be? If you could do a hands, face, space for net zero, what would it be? Thank you.
Okay, give you some time to think about that one. Next.
It's Bea Natzler from the Climate Change Committee. I was really struck in the report and the presentation by your emphasis on the small percentage impact of providing information, and also the really important role of the upstream and creating the right incentives for companies, local authorities, etc. I'm just curious, do you think there's a world where government sets policy that sets things at that level, at the upstream, such that interventions in terms of public information and campaigns provided directly by the government aren't actually needed?
Yeah, great.
Hi, yeah, I'm Beth. I'm from DEFRA. It's a really, really interesting report. I suppose I'm just thinking about in terms of the green society we're building. Obviously, we want it to be net zero, but we also want it to be sustainable in the wider sense. It delivers for the biodiversity crisis, for water, for adaptation, etc. And so I guess I had a question on how you think government can deliver cohesively across the piece for the environment. And also, I'm particularly interested in terms of your initial question to the public around sustainable behaviours that they do. Did you define for them what sustainable means? So my understanding is the public understands sustainability to sort of encompass, yes, net zero, but wider environmental stuff too. I'm just curious if you had any data or research around that.
Right.
Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, hands, face, space.
Yeah, there's lots in there. I mean, I think one of the strengths of hands, face, space is that it is so concretely linked to actual actions that people can take, and that's what's lacking often with environmental sort of campaign taglines and so on, which often sort of allude to the initiative or allude to the threat, but don't provide a really, really clear, concrete behavioural ask. I think that's potentially more difficult in this space, partly because the right actions will vary from person to person. If I rent my accommodation, I'm not going to be able to put in a heat pump or do retrofits. If I don't drive a car, that's not relevant to me, etc. So that's why we put more emphasis on personalisation and tailoring those messages. So one of our key recommendations is a sort of central information hub. We've actually built a beta version of this called getgreener.com if people want to check it out. But essentially the idea is you can put in an absolute minimum of information like your postcode, your vehicle license plate number, etc., and it will scrape publicly available data and provide to you like your top three actions, and that can be loaded up with tips and how-to guides and so on. So I think it needs to be tailored. That said, your point about a high-level narrative is still really, really important. I think one way that government should be delivering on that is leading by example more. So there are some areas in where that's already been done, like procurement rules and so on. But if it was the case that government buildings were being retrofitted and installed with heat pumps, all public vehicle fleets were electric, government catering was more plant-based, etc., I think actions can speak louder than words in terms of building that narrative. I have some thoughts on some of the other points, but do you want to add to that, Lorraine?
I'll just say something about Bea's question about kind of if you do all the upstream stuff, do you even need to do the downstream? But I think actually the report makes an important point. It wouldn't be a mandate necessarily for policymakers to feel they could do that stuff unless there had been that sort of public dialogue to build the support and in a very explicit way and bring people with you. So I think you need to do that and to show people why it's happening and to show their place in that transition and so on. So I think as well as by actually giving people very concrete information about what they can do. But I think, so I do think you need the downstream in order to get more into the upstream, actually.
And just on sustainability, in the broader sense.
Yeah, I mean, we sort of made an active choice to focus this report on net zero just because, you know, there's only so many pages we can print. But, I mean, it is clearly so important. There are some areas of big overlap, particularly food and diet, of course, which has huge impacts on biodiversity, water use, pollution, etc. I don't have a great answer as to how government can operate in a more joined-up way, but I think, you know, when it comes to discrete policies, this is part of the reason it's so difficult. If you're looking at something like an eco-label for food products, it would be potentially a bit of a catastrophe if you just focus that on carbon emissions and didn't include all these other impacts. So I think this is partly why it's taking so long to sort of develop these solutions, and that, of course, cuts across the piece. There's also a risk, of course, of crowding out public awareness and attention here, where if we focus so exclusively on climate change and all the actions that people need to take to mitigate that we sort of draw people's attention away from the biodiversity crisis, which is going to be the next big thing. We need much more joined-up government to address them together.
Let's have a last quick two questions. Lay there, and then just in front.
Thanks so much for a great event this morning. Ellie from UDAX. We're actually building a platform for residential decarbonisation, so it'll be interesting to see if we can meet your requirements there. You mentioned their retrofit installer availability. Obviously, a number of challenges with this, but one of the questions I had was the impact of that supply side on demand, on consumer behaviour. So is there any evidence to suggest that we see a lack of availability kind of impact homeowners from the perspective of sort of transferring blame or saying, oh, you know, I couldn't get anyone, so what do you expect me to do? This isn't something that is possible for me.
Okay.
Thanks.
Did one other person want to come in? Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks so much for this presentation. One question I had was regarding so the actions that can be taken upstream that then influence the whole environment is working with the financial sector. So a lot of the choices in the financial sector are driven by very short-term incentives and profitability in the short run. But also it's not just what the financial sector is doing itself, it's obviously influencing the decisions of all the companies and entities in which they are investing, which have obligations towards their shareholders and bondholders, so towards the financial sector again. And are you looking into interventions to do in this sector? What are your thoughts in this, on this area? Thank you.
Great, thank you very much. Lorraine, do you want to start?
Yeah, I guess just one brief comment on the financial one is that I think it does come back to, again, the multiple roles that people have. So most of us would have a bank account, a pension, etc., savings. And so there will be decisions that all of us could make to actually choose greener investment options. And I think that's often when we think about behaviour change, and one of the questions was, what are the impactful things we can do? And while, in terms of direct carbon, things like, you know, reducing the amount that you drive and red meat that you eat, etc., would come kind of top of that list. Those wider things, like what you can do in the workplace, what you can do as an investor, what you do as a role model within your kind of community or your family, etc., all of those things really matter too. So I think it is important. It's just to sort of agree, basically. I think that should be a real area that we should be moving into and looking at, actually, in terms of, future research.
Yeah, we sort of frame them as catalyst behaviours in the report, and they're not a major focus in the report, because in a sense, you'd be double counting, because they don't necessarily reduce emissions directly, but they impact all these other sectors that do. And I agree. I mean, there's about £3 trillion in UK pensions alone. We already default people into workplace pensions. Could you default them into green workplace pensions? That could shift quite a lot of capital in a way that could be quite useful. So, I mean, I absolutely agree with that. On supplier availability, yes, it's a huge barrier. Just anecdotally, I did my underfloor insulation last year. I literally could not find anyone who wanted to do it. They wouldn't even give me quotes because it's just a pig of a job and it's very hard to lift floorboards and so on. I ended up doing it myself. But it is a real barrier. We've done quite a bit of work with the Sustainable Energy Authority of Ireland looking at a variety of barriers to retrofit adoption. And yes, constraints in supply of installers and suppliers of products is definitely an issue.
Thank you very, very much, both of you, for a fantastic discussion. If anyone wants that underfloor heating done, Toby is available afterwards, the sideline. Thanks also for really good questions.
Thank you.